on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to the superstar Jenny Green. Jenny's back tomorrow at 3. It's Thursday, the 20th of May, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Greg Allen has the latest on day one at the USPGA as Rory returns to Kiwa Island.
This is for the all-time margin of victory in PGA Championship history.
To break Nicklaus's record of 7. Can it be? Yes! The new ruler of the game of golf is Rory McIlroy.
We're live to Paris to hear from Racing 92's Mike Prendergast on Champions Cup final. It might have two French teams, but there's lots of Irish interest.
Every time I create a game plan or ideas, I put myself there. So what would I like? And then conversely, what don't I like the opposition doing to me? So that's exactly how you try and set up your team to succeed. But
plus, we've news on the Irish women's hockey squad for an exciting summer ahead. And Jeff Shepherd on more heroics from LeBron James as the Lakers leave it late to make the playoffs.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweeting at GameOn2FM. Now we are going to get straight into the golf because the second major of the year, the US PGA Championship, is underway. And Greg Allen joins us with the latest from Kiwa Island. Greg, how are things shaping up?
Well, firstly, the wind is blowing. That's not a surprise because Kiwa Island is extremely exposed. If you can imagine a typically Irish Lynxland golf course or even anywhere by a coastline in Ireland, and there's absolutely no dunes, virtually nothing other than flat land right by the sea. So even the slightest amount of breeze is going to make it quite difficult. And it's always a heavy breeze by the sea, and it's turning out that way. Now, when you talk about a breeze of 15 to 18 miles an hour, it doesn't sound like much, especially in a country like Ireland. But in America, in Kiwa Island, it's turning, you know, in terms of Rory McIlroy, he doesn't play particularly well in the wind. It's turning his round upside down. He started quite well. He actually had a terrible tee shot. His first shot of the day was a big wipe right, a 30-yard miss, at least from where he was aiming. He did very well to make bogey from there because he had to take a drop out of a hazard. And then that bogey was followed by birdie-birdie, so he's underway. And we thought that, you know, this history that he has of making very poor starts in major championships, dating back to 2014 when he won his last major, which was a PGA Championship in Valhalla. By the way, that statistic is 32 over par for the first round of major golf championships since he last won a major golf championship. So we thought with those two birdies, you know, cancelling out that early bogey, that maybe that was going to be turned on its head. But the wind has got up since then, and he's now bogeyed 4 of his last 8 holes, and he's 3 over par, and he's played 14 holes. That sounds really bad, but in actual fact, it's about middle of the pack. A lot of other players are struggling too. Justin Thomas is 3 over par, Bryson DeChambeau's 2 over par. But the lead is at a very respectable mark of 4 under par, and it's held by Martin Laird, the number 101 ranked player in the world, something of a veteran Scot on the PGA Tour. He has PGA Tour wins to his name, but in the last 10 tournaments that he's played in, his highest finish has been 30th in 10 tournaments, his last 10, and there's been 4 missed cuts. There's been nothing to suggest that Martin Laird will go on to be the champion on Sunday, but he's certainly the leader right now, 4 under par after 16 holes, and Martin Laird leads by 1 from Keegan Bradley. Now, Bradley is a former PGA champion. He was also 3rd in Kiwa Island back in 2012, and that was the year after he won the PGA Championship in 2011. And Keegan Bradley, 3 under after 15, is alone in second place. In the group on 2 under par, Cameron Tringale, an American journeyman player, you could call him, around a 72 under par. That's the best round that's been completed so far. Also 2 under par, good to see the return to form of Henrik Stenson, who went through a really bare patch in terms of four, a barren patch in terms of form. But at the Masters, he played quite well, and here he's 2 under after 16. Victor Hovland, no surprise to see him there, the wonderkind from Norway, just a great player. 2 under par inside the world's top 15, Victor Hovland, an almost dead cert to be on Paulie Carrington's Ryder Cup team to face the Americans in September. So he's right there with 3 to play, 2 under par. Stuart Sink, the winner of the recent Heritage Classic, the veteran in his late 40s, he's 2 under par after 15. Brooks Koepka, playing on one leg, you could say, because he's got really really a serious enough knee injury that he can't bend down properly for putts. And that knee injury is said to be as taking away almost as much as 50% of his strength and power in that leg. But he's going well. He's 2 under after 14. Tom Lewis, the Englishman, 2 under par after 14. And the defending champion, Colin Morikawa, 2 under after 14. And a PGA professional, club professional, Brad Marek, he is 2 under after 12. So there is good scoring out there. Paul Casey's just completed a round of 71. Ricky Fowler, who hasn't been in good form for the last while outside the world's top 100, he shot a round of 71 for 1 under par. Tyrrell Hatton holed a bomb of a putt down on the final green for him to get in on 71, 1 under par. So there are plenty of players playing well here. So 3 over par for McIlroy with 4 to play is a little bit of a recurrence of what we've seen in him in first round of major championships over the past while. And as I said, at the moment, if that's a completed round, say today, of 75, that really is going in the typical territory of how he's played in first round of majors over the last, what, 6-7 years now. Even though he won when he last played a tournament in the Wells Fargo Championship just 2 weeks ago. So it's not going well for McIlroy. 3 over par, and that's 7 off the leader, Martin Laird.
So for anyone just tuning in now, Greg, who is out next and who can we keep an eye out for this evening?
Well, this evening, obviously, a 6:15, a few minutes away, Porter Carrington tees off alongside Phil Mickelson and Jason Day. All three of them are former PGA champions. There'll be a lot of chat in that group, I'd say, because Mickelson and Harrington are known to like a good conversation, and Harrington said, yeah, that'll be a chatty group. Also, we'll have Shane Lowry in company with world number one Dustin Johnson at 9 minutes past 7. And that'll be an interesting, obviously, for Shane. He hasn't played a competitive round at Kiawah Island before, but we know that Shane likes playing in wind. He won the Irish Open in 2009 and an awful lot of wind at Beltray, and there was a fair bit of wind in Portrush in 2019 as well. So I think Shane Lowry will like the challenge. The only problem is that the early starters had the best of the conditions, and the wind is not showing any signs of relenting for those late starters. So they will be out in the next hour or so.
Greg, Bryson DeChambeau, you said he's 2 over at the moment. You mentioned the wind, but also a long course. Could this really suit him?
You know, when you have wind blowing across players who hit the ball long and high, it gives the ball more of an opportunity to stray offline. And, you know, really in conditions like this, it's players with a mid to low ball flight who will probably prosper. Bryson really gets it up there, but he has got more control over his ball flight as he's got used to the new swing that's now, what, nearly 2 years old. He's a year and 8 months old, I think, since he unveiled his very much beefed up physique. You'd know a lot about that, of course, don't you?
I'm going the other way.
Yeah, and he's slimming down. That's true, yeah. He would make a heck of a... What position would you put him in at the scrum?
Ooh. I wouldn't put him anywhere near a scrum, to be honest. He's not that
physique-wise. I'm not talking talent-wise.
Yeah, he'd probably be a back row, to be fair. He isn't carrying enough wood to be a prop forward, but I think he'd make a decent back rower.
£230, what's that? Is that the territory of a nimble back rower, yeah, or a number six?
Yeah, you know? It's no CJ Sander, but what all of them wouldn't give to play golf like him?
Yeah, no, anyway, Bryson DeChambeau, 2 over par after 14. Also not going well, Justin Thomas, who's the world number two, who's on 3 over par. Hideki Matsuyama, the Masters champion, is 2 over par. You know, players who are really fancied coming in here, players like Bob McIntyre, who's a Scot, who's well used to playing in wind. He's finished with a round of 75. I think by the end of the day, if McIlroy gets in with 75, it won't be as damaging as other 75s that he's had in the first round of majors. And it's all about just staying in there, hanging in there, and hoping that nobody gets too far away. And then when maybe one piece of form comes his way over the next couple of days, then he makes a move back towards the lead. By the end of this week, I think a single under par figure will be the winning total. You just don't want to let it get away in the first round.
Greg, before we let you go, who has impressed you most?
Well, I mean, seeing anybody shoot 4 under or on the way to shooting 4 under par out there right now, Martin Laird, obviously, is not someone who you'd regard as someone who sustained it over the 4 days. But Keegan Bradley has impressed me the most. You know, he's not a veteran. He's in his mid-30s. He's a former PGA champion, and he played well here, finishing third in 2012 behind Rory McIlroy's runaway 8-shot win. The fact that he's back up there again, he's a very noted, fine driver of the golf ball, longish and straightish, and that's the type of player you're going to want for the entire week. Just whose nerves are going to hold up by the end of the week. I think it's very significant that a player like Brooks Koepka at 2 under par, who's a major championship winning machine, 4 major championships to his name, 2 PGA championship wins, the fact that he's up there proving that his injury is not as severe as was feared, I think is very, very indicative that he's going to be around come Sunday on the back nine.
Okay, well, it is certainly shaping up to be an interesting weekend. Greg Allen, thank you so much. We will check in with you a little bit later on. We're going to take a very quick break now, though, and then we're back to dissect the Ireland women's hockey team with Gillian Pender.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Now we are going to very quickly check in with Greg Allen, who's watching the USPGA Championship for us and has an interesting update. Greg?
Yeah, I think it's very important that Rory McIlroy has steadied the ship. He's just birdied his 15th hole, rolling in a putt of around 12, 13 feet. Went in dead centre at pace. It was a confident putt. But his very next drive, his very next shot has been to drive the ball into less than hospitable territory. Looks like really quite heavy grass. So the driver hasn't been friendly to him so far today. The putter has just given him a birdie to get him back to 2 under par with 3 to play, 2 over par with 3 to play, and I think 2 over par around a 74 by the end of the day will not be at all damaging, but he's put himself into trouble on his 16th hole, so that might be damaging.
It sure might be, Greg. Thanks as always. Now we are turning our attention to hockey because earlier today, Ireland head coach Sean Dancer named an 18-woman squad for the upcoming European Hockey Championships in the Netherlands. And we are joined now by former Ireland player Jill Pender to talk us through the squad. Jill, before we get to the squad, the competition is fierce. Can you tell us just how difficult it has been for these women to try and make it into this 18-woman squad that are going to the Netherlands?
Yeah, absolutely. The competition has always been fierce around the squad anytime I've been involved, for sure. And I suppose with the Olympic Games coming up in July and into August, that's probably the competition everybody's got their eyes on the prize for. But this Europeans, as you say, is going to double as a qualifier for the World Cup that will be held next year. So with the lack of games, you know, that the players have been afforded the opportunity to play in over the last kind of 16 months or so, it's really an opportunity for them to kind of get back into full swing of competition and the routine of tournament play.
So we have 18 women on this team, 16 who are in this squad, 16 who are squad members, and then 2 travelling reserves. Just what were your initial thoughts when you saw it today, Jill?
Yeah, I mean, there's a nice balance of probably the youth players coming through. A couple of players, I think Michelle Carey, who's uncapped, and a number of players have been in the squad for a few years, but this might be their first time playing in an international tournament. So that's kind of nicely balanced. I think there's 12 players that were on the silver medal winning World Cup team from 2018. So I'd imagine now the amount of training they've done, they're just ready to hit the ground running, and hopefully that blend of youth and energy will be kind of well molded with the experience that the other girls will bring to the squad.
So were there any surprises?
I suppose when you're getting players in that are uncapped, it's always nice to see them coming through, and maybe they're ones you don't think of at the start. It's also players returning from long breaks from the squad that have been sitting out due to injury. And then I suppose the only notable person who's been left out is Deirdre Duke, and you never know, she's named as one of the reserves, and you know, that could mean that she could end up playing in the tournament. You don't know what's going to happen with injuries as players ramp up now towards the start of this competition.
Jill, when you look at it, like you mentioned there, you know, Michelle being the one with the least amount of caps, but the experience in the squad is incredible. And for Sean Dancer, it's that, isn't it? It's bringing this group on now to, you know, reap the rewards of all the hard work they've put in.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I was looking at the caps of the players earlier on. There's 1 or 2 players that are either in the 300 caps, I think there's going to be about 3 or 4 different milestones of either 150 or 200 caps that will take place over the course of the tournament. So when you have that wealth of experience, hopefully then they'll be able to transform that into results and goals and opportunities, and generally speaking, just good performances in that build up to the Olympic Games at the end of the summer.
It was good to see Megan Fraser and also to see Lena Tice back in, because we know that they've suffered with injury, but getting their fitness right at this crucial time is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And for Megan, she's torn her ACL a couple of years ago and has had a really kind of bumpy journey in her return to play. She seems to maybe not get a good run at things before she picks up another little niggle, but I'm delighted to see her in the squad because she's such an electric player and can bring a lot to any match that she steps on the pitch for.
I was delighted, I have to say, to see Naomi Carl back in, because I know how disappointed she was when she didn't make it for the World Cup, but just to see her back and knowing the hard work as well that she's put in and getting her opportunity is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's another one of those players that is recovering or has recovered from an ACL injury in kind of the last maybe two years or so. So to see her, you know, being so close to that World Cup squad, just missing out and now being in with the shot of going to the Olympic Games after this Europeans is brilliant to see and just shows you that, you know, you can overcome these nasty setbacks that you might have and reap the benefits in the end.
And what about the goalkeeper? Was it a bit of a surprise to see Lizzie Murphy in and Grace Flanagan out?
No, I think Grace stepped away from the programme after the World Cup in 2018, and Lizzie's been there and in the background working very, very hard. And because the number one goalkeeper, Aisha McFerrin, has been playing professionally over in Holland, it's really given the likes of Lizzie Murphy an opportunity to step through and play in those kind of uncapped friendly games that have occurred over the last while behind closed doors. And she's obviously impressed, and I'm glad to see that she's getting an opportunity now to play.
And Jill, just on it, looking at the fixtures, some, you know, really challenging games, but also opportunity, like you said, to develop a squad. So we get underway against the Netherlands, the host, but also world number one, then on to play Scotland and then taking on Spain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the opening game against the Dutch will be the first time that Ireland have played them since that World Cup final. And, you know, they are the number one team in the world. They've been consistently winning medals at the top level over a long period of time now. So that team is going to be a very difficult team to get a result off. But it maybe isn't totally about getting 3 points or even 1 point off them, and it's just setting the kind of the pace for you know just good performances. And if they're happy with how they've played against Holland, regardless of the result, it sets them up nicely then to take on Scotland, where they'd be expected to win and hopefully can win by a couple of goals, then to decide when they play Spain in the final game as to which of those two teams will go through to the semi-finals and which of them will be playing in a relegation pool then at the end of the tournament.
There was a media day today opportunity to interview many of the players, and our reporter caught up with Katie Mullen.
If we finish top five in the European Championships now in June, that would secure our qualification for next year's World Cup. And I think we talk about wanting to play in the major tournaments. So at this moment in time, that is our number one goal for this team is to secure qualification for next year's World Cup and get that top five finish. So that requires a top performance for us across the board at the Europeans, and that's our number one aim at the minute.
Jill, I think it's important to point out, because people probably wouldn't know, that a European Championship ahead of an Olympics isn't just a tournament to warm up for an Olympic Games. This is really important to Irish hockey.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Europeans is probably the most difficult continental games out there. You know, from the World Cup medal winners and the last Olympic Games medal winners, all teams came from Europe in those events. So the quality of teams and opposition that you're playing is really difficult to even remain in the top tier, let alone finishing in top five, top four, top three, where you're fighting for medals. So as Katie had said there, World Cup qualification is the main goal, but I think the team now, having had a bit of success over the last little while, they're really looking to push on, and they're not looking to just remain in the top tier anymore. They want to finish in a semi-final spot and be fighting for a medal when the last game of the tournament comes around.
Yeah, and they have a really grueling schedule ahead with 5 games in 8 days, and we wish them all the best. Jill Pender, thanks so much for joining us. We'll probably see you in the coverage over the next few months. Look forward to hearing and seeing more of you, and we'll talk to you soon. We're going to take a very quick break now.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on, rugby.
Okay, two of Munster greats have hopped the ditch and are now coaching in the top league of France in their top 14. One is coaching La Rochelle in the Heineken Champions Cup final this Saturday. The other joins us on the line now, Racing 92's Mike Prendergast. A boy, a kid.
How are we doing, guys? How are you?
We're great.
Prendy, I know it's tough, especially watching Champions Cup final when you've ambitions of being in there. And for Racing, this was another year that you would have been disappointed not to be at the business end.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, I suppose, in the same season. In October, we lost the final against Exeter. Tough one to take. And obviously, our ambition was to get back into the final and go one further, but it wasn't to be. We lost to Bordeaux in the quarter final, which was a disappointing performance, to be honest, Joe. We didn't fire enough shots, to be fair, and we came up short. So a disappointing campaign for us. Fortunately, for the top 14, we're third at the moment, so with two games left. So hopefully we can make the playoffs there and push on for a bit of silverware.
And then from a personal point of view, what's life like in France, and when's the last time you even got to get home?
Yeah, it's been quite bizarre. I suppose, look, it's the same for everybody, but not getting home, I suppose, was something that getting home was something you'd always look forward to. I haven't been home actually in about a year and a half, so hopefully we'll see what happens over the next couple of months or so and try and make my way back. But yeah, look, we're getting amateurs here. Actually, Paris and France itself has opened up a bit since yesterday. The terraces and stuff are which is a big part of the life here in Paris. They've opened their terraces, the restaurants, I should say. So there's a bit more life happening here, and over the next few weeks and few months, there'll be a bit more going on. So hopefully we can get back to some bit of normality.
Mike, that must be tough. You know, I know you're plying your trade over there, but to be away from home for so long and, you know, missing out on your family and big occasions.
Yeah, look, it's part of being away. You kind of you do get used to them. I'm away nearly, 8 years now, and I had a stint as a player for 2 years. So you kind of get used to, and as a coach, you remember Dunners when you were playing as well. There was often, you know, big events that you just missed. It's just part of the job. I suppose, look, the frustrating thing is, especially when I'm living in Paris, because it's quite accessible to get in and out of, and you know, you're regularly getting home, or you know, every 3 or 4 or 5 months, kind of. But unfortunately, as I said, we haven't been home, and I haven't been home myself in a year and a half. So, but look, hopefully, something will open up, and we might be able to get back over the next, as I said, month or two.
There is one Munster man heading back home very, very shortly. Simon Zeebo. How much of an addition do you think he's going to be to the Munster team and set up?
He'll be huge, Marie. I'm sad to see him go, to be honest with you, from here. He's been excellent for us. And he's such a positive guy as well. He obviously has a very good skill set as a rugby player. You know, that he'll add a huge amount to Munster. He brings something different in terms of the way he plays, and just his kicking game also. Having a left footer is going to be something that's very valuable to any team as well. And the other thing is, he's just such a positive guy to be around, and he's a great team player for everybody, and he's been a joy to coach. So look, he'll be a loss for us, but he'll be certainly a huge gain for Munster.
In Racing, it suited him. It enabled him to express his personality. Do you think he's going to be able to do that in the way that Munster set up?
I think he will. Simon will always be himself. That's what I like about him. He's you know, I think from a playing point of view, he'll, as I said, he's got a different kind of skill set as well. Just the way he's running lines and stuff like that, he can be a hard man to defend. That's why he scores a lot of tries, and he's been a prolific scorer for Munster, and same for us over here. You know, even look at the final, the Champions Cup final, he scored 2 tries that day, especially one of them just a really good late line that he cuts. So he'll bring a different skill set. And I think, you know what, he'll bring... I know at home he's very popular with the fans, and I'm sure they're delighted to see him come back, and he'll bring that excitement and that, as I said, that positivity. He's a really positive guy to be around, and it's infectious, and he was a very popular member of our playing group over here, you know. So there'll be a lot of positives for him to bring home with himself.
France does sound like a fascinating place to learn your stripes and to be coaching, and it is two French teams in the Champions Cup final. Were you surprised to see La Rochelle there?
I'd say if you asked me to start of the season, I would have said yes, but as the season's progressed, I just think they're a team that are, you know, in terms of performance, just keep snowballing. They just seem to be getting better and better and more confident. They're very, very well coached. Obviously, they've a very good balance, I think, to their side. But the question you're asking me, am I surprised? I'm not over the last, I suppose, 3 or 4 months. You know, for me, they are the most consistent team in France, and you know, probably Europe, you can say as well, especially after the performances they had. And even to go to somewhere like Gloucester and win, I know people might think it's the hardest place to go. I thought it was a very, very good performance over there, and obviously then to beat, you know, Leinster, anything that beats Leinster is obviously a very good side. But I like the way I just like the balance of their team in terms of, you look at their 8, 9 and 10, 3 Kiwis, a lot of experience there. And then there's that mixture of young French players that are, you know, part of that French team. And you look at Bougarie at hooker, Aldred at 6 or 8, if Victor Vido plays or not. And then you have the likes of Brice Jolan, who was with us previously in Racing. They brought him down, and he's actually, after, you know, breaking through back into the French team after being out for a good few years. So they have a real good balance to their team, and they're a team that they just look like they're every week, they're just, the confidence is growing, and they look like a very tight-knit group. And I fancy them on Saturday purely because I just think they have the bit between their teeth at the moment.
Mike, is that such an important part of it? Now, you mentioned 10 different nationalities, and look, we can see the reflections on the pitch of the likes of John O'Gibbs and Ron Nogara in the performance, but bringing it all together, the culture, I can't find a better word, and I know it gets thrown around an awful lot, but if you can get that right, is that a massive work on for you? Are you constantly thinking, how do I develop a better relationship with these lads?
Yeah, I think, look, relationships in anything, in any walk of life, in any job, in any sport is a fundamental thing. You know, you have to have that. You look at it and you even read the, you know, some of the articles there, and those players want to play for John and they want to play for Rog. You can hear it, you can see it, and I think the proof is in the pudding at the moment. You just, with their performances, they give huge belief in their coaching, in their coaching staff down there, and these are world class players that are talking like this, that have been coached by world class coaches. So you know, I think the boys have done an incredibly good job there. I think the recruitment was really smart at the start of the year to bring in guys like, obviously, Will Skelton, who was you know, he was with Saracens, he'd won Champions Cup. It's not as if he was, but to manage to get him there, you know, probably took a bit of convincing, I'm sure, because La Rochelle were kind of, you know, they were setting out in their, I suppose, on their pathway, and to get someone like him and to bring him in, and he's been a massive asset down there in terms of their, and you'd appreciate it, Dunners, in terms of their set piece, trying to maul against them is, you know, straight away you have a weapon taken away from you, because they destroy mauls between himself and Antonio. And then they brought in a couple of South African boys as well, and Dylan Leeds and Raymond Rule, who was in Grenoble, playing Pro D2. So, and obviously Brice Jolan, who I mentioned about, and the one other guy, I think that he kind of resembles of how La Rochelle are going, especially over the last number of months, is Area West of 10. I just think you look at him last year, even, you know, he wasn't just putting up trees, but this year, over the last 3 or 4 months, his game has just grown and grown, and I'm sure that's a huge. Rogers had a huge influence there, and I think he's key to everything that they've been doing over the last kind of couple of months. So they just seem to have it right, and as you said, the culture. I know Ronan from his time down in the Crusaders, he obviously had a lot of learnings from that side of things with Scott Robinson down there, and he brought that skill set along with his own technical and tactical ability. But in terms of how he manages the team and how he's built the relationships and what they do off the pitch, in terms of what they do and the length of time they're on the pitch, they seem to have the right balance there. They look fresh all the time. They don't have too many injuries. So everything is pointing in the right direction for them, and credit to Raj and Jano for really bringing it together.
Because it's
in a very short space of time, I should say. Sorry.
Yeah, just on that, because it's a lesson to all coaches. Like the examples you've given are brilliant, and the one that stands out for me is Will Skelton. When he was with Saracens, he was an impact player, Prendy. He used to come off the bench for the last 30 minutes. But in La Rochelle, we've seen him doing 80-minute stints now, no problem at all. It's Jono Gibbs and Ron O'Gara saying to him, no, you're a starter, and you know, as a player, you'd grow a foot knowing that someone's going to back you like that.
Absolutely, and I think they put a bit of pressure on him from the get-go to get fitter, and he alluded to that himself. He mentioned about Raj had a few quiet words with him about, you know, trying to improve his fitness, and he's went away and he's done it. And as I said, he's such an important player for them, because, as I said, from their own mould, which is a very it's a huge weapon to have in any team. But you know, from an attacking point of view, to have that from their mould, but also from a defensive point of view as well. As I said, he's breaking moulds up 4 or 5 seconds or 10 seconds into. And he set up, you know, so that's a huge weapon to have. And as you said, he's not a guy that, for his size, he's not a guy that's, you know, going off after 60 minutes. He's playing these 80 minutes. And the same with Antonio. You look at a big man at tight head prop there, and you looked at the Leinster game, the last day, and the heat was there. I think most of us felt that, you know, potentially two players like that might fall away a bit in 60-65 minutes, but it was them that were plugging away at the end, and Skelton came up with a try. I think it was maybe 60-70 minutes into the game. So there's, as I said, there's a lot going right on down there, and it's huge credit. And as I said, in quite a short space of time, you know, when you look at where they were last year to where they've came in, a you know, within not even 12 months, you look at 6 months, the whole thing just changed down there. And speaking to people that are in the know, and I suppose players and stuff, and the world coming out of there, it's been a really happy camp, and that's, once you get that right, if you get your environment and your culture right, everything else will fall into place, you know, in terms of the tactical. And if you're a coach and you've that tactical and the technical side right, you know, it becomes a hard thing to break down, you know, and that's what they are at the moment.
Mike, Toulouse do have the X-factor players, though, the Cheslin Colbys and the Antoine Duponts. How do they contain players like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I had a good chat with Raj about it yesterday. They're the type of team, and they're the type of the two players you mentioned, in Antoine Dupont and Chelsea Colby. They are the type of players that can just score off nothing. And yeah, look, I think the positive thing and the confidence La Rochelle can bring into the final, you know, you speak about obviously attacks, we speak about mauls and everything, but look, I know it's a bit of a cliche, defences win championships and win trophies, and you look at La Rochelle this year in top 14, they're 100 points clear in terms of their statistics, in terms of their defence, you know, they've 100 points less conceded than the second team, so defence is a massive part of their DNA down there, and it's something to do really well. They've got a rush defence, and it needs to be on the ball on Saturday, because when you have players like the two boys that we mentioned, they can score from nothing. That's the thing off you know, turnover ball or counter attack, they're lethal. But look, knowing Raj, and spoken to him over yesterday, actually, you know, they're well aware, like every team, you know, it's one thing saying and another thing putting it into place, and that's the challenge that will be there. But I do feel that the other thing is there's two players that are, looks like they're going to be out. Well, one is definitely is Marchand, the hooker. He's their captain. He's an incredibly good player. He's so good on the deck. He slows ball down. He's just a massive part of what they do. So he's out with suspension. And Zach Holmes looks like he's not going to make it. He's probably a player that people don't speak about enough, or too much, I should say, because obviously the likes of DuPont and Tomac and these guys and Colby probably take over more so. But Zach Holmes is a player that there isn't much said about him, but he's just a really smart footballer, plays 13 for him, and he's kind of that calmness in midfield, and he's a X10, so he's a guy you can see that he takes a lot of pressure off the likes of Entomac, who for me, since his injury, maybe hasn't hit his straps yet, but look, Saturday could be the time he does it. And the other thing with that is the weather is going to probably play a big part in it as well, because I don't think the weather looks too good for the weekend, so it's an intriguing game to look forward to.
Yeah, I can't wait for it. Mike, before we leave you go, would you call it? Who do you think will come out on top?
I think, look, obviously from an Irish point of view and a Munster point of view, I'd love to see Raj for himself to win it. I think for his coaching, since he's started his coaching journey, it's going to be, you know, he's won a top 14 here with Racing, and he's won two Super Rugby championships with Crusaders, but I think this will top everything off. And I think La Rochelle will go on to win it. I just think they've the bit between their teeth, and another one who's kind of, it's up in the air at the moment, and just looking at the weather is Bottia, if he's going to play or not, the 12 who went off against Leinster, but there's positive enough vibes coming out that he will play. And I just think that, as I said, they're the bit between their teeth at the moment. They're on a roll, they're confident, saying that Toulouse can score from anything, but I'm going to go with La Rochelle.
Fair play, Tim. Mike, we know it's tough for you and it'll be a hard watch because you want to be there, but thanks so much for joining us this evening, and best luck, and hopefully catch up with you real soon.
Game on, rugby.
Dominic, it's fascinating to hear Mike Prendergast talking about rugby there, and we do have a longer version of that which will be podcasted. I think he probably speaks for everyone here in Ireland when he says that everybody wants to see Ronan Nagara do well and for La Rochelle to go out and get the win. But is it realistic to think that they can do that?
I think if you look at the Leinster game, Marie, yeah, if they perform like that, they certainly have a chance. I do think Toulouse are better. If you look at the Munster game, Munster versus Toulouse, it was like they just dropped a gear at a certain point and were just able to pull away. And you asked him the question about the X-factor players. And it's so funny. We were chatting about it earlier on. Before, it was quite easy to win if you had a high work rate and you were good at set piece. Now you have to have players that can do different things. And Toulouse have got that. And look, purists of rugby would love the tradition and the history that Toulouse come with. You know, La Rochelle, to be fair, it's been quick. And, you know, part of me, as much as I love Rog and you want to see him do really well, and I think Prendy's in that bubble as well where you want to see your friend do well, but I think tradition and history matters when it comes to big games. I don't see, Toulouse looking beyond Toulouse.
You could have said that, though, before the Leinster game. And I'm sure we probably did say that the history and tradition that the club like Leinster had was going to count for a lot. And then La Rochelle came out and pulled off a performance that very few people were expecting. I think everybody that was expecting it did come out of the woodwork and say they predicted it. But it was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, it was. And look, that's where they need to go. La Rochelle need to do that again. But you have to admire what Toulouse have done as well, because rugby has changed, and they do have, you mentioned Colby's, the X Factor players they have, World Cup winners, they're the ones everyone wants to see. But they brought through an awful lot of their own again, and I think to see Toulouse back at the top table, just as a purist of rugby, is brilliant to see. It would be brilliant to see the Perpignans, the Barits, all the teams we're used to. But the game has changed and money's important, and look, as much as we like it, isn't it great for La Rochelle to be able to put on that? And like, where does that come from? You know, it comes from being able to buy it, and unfortunately rugby has taken that shape. So look, it'll be a brilliant final, it really will be.
And there'll be fans there, Donegal.
All of them with Cork accents. Yeah. But look, it'll be great for Rog, and an incredible journey. But I think you know, it was brilliant listening to Prendy there, and you mentioned the podcast. I'd recommend listening to it because he gives great detail on Finn Russell. Just I think that's quite important, because I've been a little bit tough on Finn Russell at times.
Finn Russell's like our show pantomime villain, isn't he?
absolutely. But Prendy, he does give good context on just his abilities to do things so late at the line, and I thought it was really interesting where he was quite straight up and said that he would have brought Johnny.
Did he change your mind on Finn Russell?
No, look, it's just a preference thing. And like, I wish I was a different type of player that could play the type of talented game that Finn Russell wants to play. But give me a Ron Nogara that kicks the corners and keeps me going forward. And that's the type of rugby I played, although it's all changing now. So
I was about to say, maybe it's a mindset thing from Munster that if you did start engaging with players like Finn Russell, that you're heading for all the Champions Cup finals there every year.
Well, hopefully there's a few of them coming. To be fair, there is good talent in that 10 spot, and a few of them playing sevens as well at the moment. So if you want to get that skill set, it's certainly important. Okay, time to head on. We're delighted to cross the Atlantic, head stateside, and join our great team mate Jeff Shepherd. How are you?
Hey guys, how are y'all doing today? I'm great.
Shep, we're really happy, and we'll get on about the NBA and the LeBron's brilliant basket, but there was super news today, not only for Irish sport, for Irish hospitality and tourism, because the Aer Lingus College Football Classic has been announced. It's going to go ahead on the 27th of August 2022 in the Aviva Stadium, but brilliant to have this game, and hopefully a load of Americans coming back home.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, I know a couple of years ago Notre Dame played a game there, and you know, Notre Dame's nickname is the Fighting Irish, so it just kind of goes without saying that, you know, they were a pretty popular team to be playing over in the States. But yeah, they made the announcement earlier today. You're going to have the Northwestern Wildcats, which is a team. It's a private school, but they're in Chicago, Illinois. It's a big school. It's a very well-respected school all across America. Going to be taking on the Nebraska Cornhuskers, and I know Marie chuckled at that name. Nebraska's out in the, just kind of in the middle of the country. It's a Midwestern state. It's out in the Great Plains, and yes, they're known for their corn. That is their number one,
Simple as that, Chip.
What's that?
Simple as that. That's what it is.
It's as simple as that, yeah. There's really no novelty there. But they are an American college football traditional powerhouse. I mean, they've won multiple national championships in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And quite honestly, I mean, their team in 1995 is arguably one of the best teams that they've ever had play in college football. And so, but I think to the point, you know, really with the thing we've been talking about for the last 12, 13 months, whatever it is now, you know, it's just a great sign that we're moving out of this phase and starting to put all this stuff behind us and hopefully getting back to traditional life and traditional sports. And I will do want to mention that the head coach of the Northwestern Wildcats is named Patrick Fitzgerald.
Ah.
So if you're looking for a rooting interest, that might be where you start.
Well, Shep, we're going to give you some homework. We want you, the next time you come back on, to have found out what his connection is to Ireland, because with a name like that, it definitely sounds like he has one.
He's probably got people somewhere over there, yes. All right, I'll see what I can find out.
Definitely.
So tell us a little bit about the Big Ten Conference and just give us some context on, you know, how good these two teams are coming, because we are kind of used to the big names, the Notre Dames and the Navies coming over, and these ones are unfamiliar. Right.
Sure. So the Big Ten is the conference that like Ohio State and Michigan play in. So those would probably be the two, you know, most familiar names from that part of the country. So, you know, you're talking about the, you know, the Midwest. You know, you got the Southeastern Conference down where I am, where we typically talk a lot about with the Alabamas and the Clemsons and the LSUs. And then this is, you know, kind of in between Canada and the South. You've got the Midwest there. So Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Iowa, you know, places like that. I mean, and these schools in particular, again, Nebraska was a powerhouse in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and they've kind of fallen off the map. I mean, they've not been terrible, really, but they've not been as good as they were years and years ago. And Northwestern's more of an academic school, but Fitzgerald has taken them to several bowl games and, you know, 10-win seasons and different things like that. And so I think it's going to, you know, it'll be a good football game. I mean, I don't think you're going to get over there and you're going to have somebody win, you know, 50-2 or anything like that. I mean, I think it's going to be a hard-nosed, you know, if you're looking for a game that might resemble a little bit of rugby, you know, you're going to have Nebraska and Northwestern. I think that would be a fitting, you know, pair of schools to do that.
I know from chatting to the ground staff in the Aviva, they can't get the dressing rooms big enough for the whole squad to get in around each other, so it would be tricky for them. But just for the players themselves and even the College Football League, to, you know, it's brilliant for us, and there will be a lift in hospitality and tourism, of course, but for them travelling over, is this a game that they look forward to?
Oh, absolutely. What they'll do, Donners, is they typically have played these games, whether they've been in Ireland or if they've played, I think they played one in Japan a couple of years ago. They'll put it very early, like it'll be the first game of the season, but it'll even be like 2 weeks before the rest of college football even kicks off, because they'll want the players to be able to travel over there, get it a chance to experience some of the country, you know, and then come back home. And, you know, you got to get your body back acclimated and all that different stuff. And so it will be greatly anticipated as we move through the summer next season, next year, because it'll be the, what it really means is that football's kicking off a week or two earlier than it typically does. It typically kicks off the first weekend of September in the United States. And so this game will be, you know, 10 days before that, which just means that we get to football earlier and the offseason is shorter next year. And everybody's a fan of that.
Chef, staying with the football. It was a rumor a few weeks ago, but it is reality now. Tim Tebow is back in the NFL.
Yeah, he officially signed a one-year contract with the Jacksonville Jaguars this morning. You know, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and just that, you know, that name, that cachet that goes with it. Guys, it's just going to be fascinating. I mean, he hasn't played in 6 years. He's going to go play a position that he has not ever really played before. I just find it incredibly interesting that, you know, he's going to make a go for it and make a run for it. I mean, I don't know. I hope he doesn't get hurt. I wish him all the luck in the world. But it's just so strange. You just don't see something like this happen. I mean, it's not like he's some random guy off the street. He's clearly, you know, a gifted athlete, and everybody knows who he is. But this is kind of unprecedented. I mean, you know, teams don't just randomly sign 33-year-olds or however old he is that haven't played football in 6 years. This is really going to be interesting to watch this play out.
Shep, you sound like an Irish mother when you say you hope he doesn't get hurt. But just on a one-year contract, probably reflected in what you're saying there. But, you know, this is becoming more and more popular in other games. Is there security in this for him, or do you think he feels, I'll give it a go for a year, and if it doesn't work out, I'm quite happy to walk away?
Well, who knows what he'll do after he's done with this phase of football. I think, Donners, you know, not having seen all the details of the contract yet, I would assume there's going to be some nice bonuses in there for making the team, catching 5 touchdowns, you know, catching 30 balls, whatever some of those incentives. I mean, I don't imagine that they're going to sign him to a one-year, $7 million contract. I mean, I don't think that's going to be the case here. So I think it'll probably be an incentive-laden contract with, you know, probably some easy mile markers that he could hit and, you know, pick up some bonus money, and then some more difficult ones as well. Look, I also think, though, that, you know, he's going to have a tough go at it. I mean, he is going to have a target on his back just, I mean, because of the whole circumstances of who he is and his former position and not having played in quite some time. That to me is going to be, you know, the thing to watch, is how does he react to the stuff that's going to be coming at him at this new position.
Now, Shep, speaking of superstars, LeBron stepped up as he always seems to, and he hit a monster 3-point shot to secure the Lakers' playoff spot overnight.
Yeah, they were playing the Golden State Warriors last night, and, you know, it tipped off at about, I don't know, 11 o'clock over here, you know, in the central time zone. So it was on at like 3 in the morning. So if anybody was up super early over there, they could have watched it or working the late shift or something. He hits a 3 as the shot clock's running down, right around a minute to go, to break up a tie game with the Warriors. And it actually wound up being what the final score was. Neither team scored another point the rest of the game. He's had a pretty bad ankle sprain. He's missed most of the last month and a half, 2 months of the season. But, you know, they're going to go into the playoffs as the 7 seed. And, you know, they're the defending NBA champions, and they've got LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and they're the 7 seed. So they're actually the favorites to beat the Phoenix Suns in the first round of the playoffs, just because of who they are and the experience that they have. But, I mean, they are not the same team that they were last year. But, I mean, again, that was an incredible shot that he hit last night. I mean, it wasn't just a regular three-pointer. He was 7 or 8 feet behind the three-point line. He kind of just threw it up and it went in, and he just got poked in the eye a couple of minutes beforehand. So, all in all, it was a pretty tremendous shot.
Just on that, you mentioned the ankle injury, but the worst injury known to any player is a poke in the eye. Like, I'm reading his quote here, it's a classic Rocky. He was seeing 3 and just went for the one in the middle.
That's right. Hit the one in the middle, right, Rock? Yeah. It's either Rocky or Bugs Bunny. It's one of the two, yeah.
But an incredible bit of skill.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just an incredibly clutch shot. And look, I mean, he's playing against Steph Curry, who we all know is obviously one of the best shooters in NBA history. And even Steph said after the game, he was like, tough shot, can't take anything away from him. And I didn't even think Steve Kerr was proud of the effort that his team gave out in that game, the defense they played. It's just, look, sometimes the shots go in and you don't draw it up like that, but it just happens.
Shep, thank you so much for joining us, as always. And don't forget your little bit of homework. You have to find out where Patrick is from. We really appreciate you taking our call. We are going to cross back over now to Greg Allen. And Greg, I'm looking at the top of that leaderboard and it is looking tasty since we last chatted to you.
Yeah, it's looking tasty, but not if you're Rory McIlroy, who's 3 over par playing the final hole. And you know, as this round has unfolded and McIlroy did get off to a poor start with a bogey in the first, it could have been a double bogey, and in many ways he might have felt good about that bogey. But since then, he made a couple of birdies after that, got under par figures, was 1 under playing a seventh hole, and then came 5 bogeys in the last 10 holes. And it's having that look of unravelling ever so slightly, as we have seen from McIlroy in first rounds of major championships. And the difference is that he's come into this with a win under his belt in his last tournament, and thereby he just doesn't want to let the lead get too far away from him. Currently, he's 6 off the lead, and that lead is a tasty group of players. Among them, Keegan Bradley, who's the winner of this tournament back in 2011, this championship back in 2011. He's just tapped in 18 for a round of 69, and that's the second round of 69 that's being completed, because Victor Hovland has also shot a round of 69, both 3 under par, out on the course with 1 hole to play. 2 really notable players, Brooks Koepka, defying this knee injury that looks like it probably won't be right for another 6 months at least, saying that he has only got maybe 50% of what he would normally have in terms of strength in that knee, and yet here he is 3 under par after 17 holes, and a hugely proficient player in major championships. We know he's got 2 US Opens and 2 US PGA championship victories to his name, and here he is chasing a 5th and a very, very live contender. He just turns up at majors, there's no question. When he's fit, he certainly turns up at majors, and here he is not totally fit and he's turning up at a major. So Koepka has to now be looked at as a serious contender, but so too is Hovland. Hovland has this terrific record, 6 top 10, top 6 finishes in fact in his last 10 tournaments, really coming into his own. He's now the world number 11, Victor Hovland, the young 24-year-old from Norway. So he's very much in contention and tied for the lead after 69. Keegan Bradley can't be discounted because he was a course specialist here, 3rd behind McIlroy back in 2012, and the winner, as I said, 10 years ago at the PGA. Still a very decent player. Bradley with that 69. And also, we just say that Rory McIlroy has just shook hands on the 18th, and that is a round of 75 to be confirmed. But that lead group is very, very tasty as you speak. So just to recap, Bradley, Hovland, Koepka and Colin Morikawa, the defending champion, all 3 under par, Morikawa with 1 hole to play. And the group on 2 under par includes Martin Laird, who set a very early pace, got to 4 under at one stage. And on 1 under par, Ricky Fowler, back to form, outside the top 100 these days. Paul Casey also a 1 under par round, a 71 for him. Tyrrell Hatton, a 71. Paddy Carrington is part of his first hole, underway in the wind. He's playing alongside Phil Mickelson and Jason Day, and Dustin Johnson and Shane Lowry will be out in a few minutes time, just at before 7:10, starting their round near the end of the field, with the breeze now blowing at about 15 to 20 miles an hour, and probably a testing time ahead for those players.
Greg, brilliant, thanks so much. We'll catch up with you tomorrow. Let's hope for a great weekend of it. Okay, that's it from all of us. A massive thank you to Dave Jarlett and Ronan, the hardest working DJ in Ireland. Is up next, Tara Stewart.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern.